From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Near Eastridge.
Sunset.
Eastside. San Francisco.
Border of Venus.
San Jose.
Coming up, we'll check in on the Port of Oakland, where workers and management have hit an impasse.
The chances of a strike could be about 50-50 right now.
Then we'll walk in the shoes of three people who live on San Francisco's streets as they look for work.
I'm a felon without a driver's license, and so, you know, even if I did have an address, that would put a pretty big damper on a lot of jobs.
And another installment in our series on the sharing economy. It's about a dance event in Berkeley that truly asks you to come as you are.
You don't need any formal training. There's no steps. It's like a dance in your living room with your friends.
The economy, living in, outside, and around it. Today on Cross Currents. Today, the East Bay Express is reporting that Port of Oakland workers may go on strike for the first time in 41 years. Recently, contracts between the SEIU and three other unions representing port workers expired. SEIU says port management is asking for major concessions, including an increased 5% employee contribution to pension plans and no cost of living increase in wages.
So the port is actually experiencing a good economic run right now. After the downturn of 2008-2009, revenues rebounded pretty sharply. The port has growing revenue surpluses, and most of the bond rating agencies, the business press, and other companies that are invested in or interested in the port's economic performance, they're saying that the port is going to only prosper in the future.
Darwin Bond Graham wrote the East Bay Express article, which reports that workers and port management have now reached an impasse as SEIU's members voted down the port's most recent takeaway offer. The dispute is now in mediation, one of the last stages before a possible strike.
We got here after about 1 year of negotiations between the port and its workers. The port, the management of the port and its board of directors have stuck to their demands, which are that the workers take essentially a 10% pay cut. The workers, on the other hand, do not see any justice in that proposal, given the fact that the port has experienced growing revenues over the last several years since the economic downturn in 2009.
So the port initially, after the economic downturn, saw a decrease in revenue, and then what happened?
Yeah, in 2008 and 2009, the Port of Oakland did experience a contraction. Revenues and throughput at the port, the maritime operations, dropped by single digits each year. The next year, 2010, was a very strong recovery for the port. And since then, revenues have been growing, so that in fiscal year 2010, the actual revenues for the port was $285 million. Fiscal year 2011, it was $297 million. So it's been growing. There have been pretty significant surpluses at the port since the economic downturn in 2009.
But in these negotiations, port management is saying that they can't afford these wage increases.
Yeah, they're saying that giving the workers a 5% cost of living increase would make it more expensive for them to borrow money from big banks and other underwriters who lend them the money to do capital improvements.
What kind of capital improvements do they want to make?
So the Port of Oakland is rebuilding the Army base with a huge logistics operation. They want to do improvements at the different terminals where operators like SSA and others operate the cranes and, you know, move shipments off of incoming ships. They want to deepen channels to bring in bigger ships. They want to do capital improvements at the airport so that they can compete better with SFO. There's all sorts of projects that they want to spend money on.
And so they're at an impasse right now. You say there's potentially a 50-50% chance of a strike. The last strike at the port was in 1971 over the changing container technology, I believe. And that strike lasted, that was the ILWU, the Longshoremen's Union, that lasted for 100 days.
Yeah, 100 days would be a very significant blow to the port's operations. Even shutting the port down for one day, you're talking about the loss of millions of dollars in revenues due to shipments and so forth. The other thing there is that that previous strike was the maritime operations. The ILWU union is only involved in the maritime operations of the Port of Oakland. People need to remember that the Port of Oakland is actually a big maritime facility and also an airport that not only flies passenger services, but also is a major like freight air freight terminal facility. So shutting down both the airport and the maritime operations would be a really big deal, even if it was only for a few days. We're talking many millions of dollars in revenues lost.
In revenues lost, and what other effects would people who live in the Bay Area feel?
If the four unions that are in negotiations right now went on strike, it's very likely that the airport would shut down, if not be very significantly disrupted. And there are a lot of businesses in the Bay Area that do business through the Port of Oakland, through the maritime terminals and so forth. And they would have to reroute shipping through Long Beach or through Seattle or some other port.
How many workers are we talking about? Who works at the port, and what are their average salaries?
I know it's at least in the hundreds, the several hundreds. So we're talking hundreds of workers who do very critical jobs for the port. The other thing is that in the last 3-4 years, they've actually laid off, and through attrition, laid off quite a few workers at the port, so that the workers there are actually doing more labor now than they previously have done. So it's a bit harder on them. The salaries that they make, you know, range from $50,000 to maybe $100,000. These are working class jobs. They make about $50,000 to $100,000. I believe the president of the SEIU 10-to-1 port chapter, he makes in the $70,000 range of money. They're not highly compensated jobs for the most part.
Darwin Bond Graham is a reporter with the East Bay Express. You can find a link to his report on the port at klw.org. And you can find all of the East Bay Express stories at eastbayexpress.com. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. The port workers we just heard about are fighting for better working conditions, but many people these days are simply fighting for work. And that fight is especially hard if you're homeless. Reporter Julia Scott spent some time with three people either currently or formerly living on San Francisco's streets. She witnessed their struggle to find jobs and to simply survive day to day. Here are their stories.
Joseph Luna woke up this morning in a sleeping bag under the Harrison Street on-ramp to Highway 101. He sleeps here when he needs to get out of the rain. I arrive at 7:30. He's still asleep, curled up on a bed of cardboard and wood chips.
Morning, Joseph.
Morning. I need some coffee bad now.
How did you sleep?
Not too bad. This redwood mulch stuff, it's soft. Compared to the cement, it's a lot better than cement. I went to bed like 9:30, 10 o'clock.
Luna doesn't sleep past 8 because he'll get rousted by police. His sleeping spot is near a five-way intersection in back of a city tow lot, not exactly camouflaged. He gets up, stacks the cardboard, and starts shoving his stuff into a big black duffel bag, the only bag he owns.
I got baby wipes and shaving cream and Purell, a little bit of soap, and some flip-flops.
He holds up a blanket.
It looks like a little kid's blanket, kind of a nanny blanket, you know? It's weird, but it's like security, some sort of little security blanket. At my age, that's a joke, but, you take what you can get.
Luna's 38. He's sleeping on the street because shelters remind him too much of his time in prison. He hasn't showered in a couple of weeks. He's medium build, scruffy, with black wavy hair. He fell asleep last night reading an historical novel. Breakfast is the same as dinner last night, a bag of Pepperidge Farm cookies.
I'm going to go see if I can get my hands on some coffee, and then I'm going to go to my clinic. After that, I usually go back up to the UN Plaza and see if I can, you know, meet up with people that I know, and, you know, see if people are okay and if everyone's still alive and all that stuff, you know.
Here in San Francisco, I spent time with three people who lost their homes and everything else. Everyone you'll hear in this story went to college. They're sober, they're smart, yet they're still homeless. Luna comes to the public library to regroup. He spends a lot of time sitting and waiting and reading.
This book was on hold for me. I want to try to check it out.
Okay, sure. There you go.
Losing a job is the biggest cause of homelessness in San Francisco. The main reason the homeless stay unemployed is lack of job training. But there are other reasons, too. One of them seems obvious. No permanent address. No address, no ID. No ID, no job. Luna needs an ID, but he also needs job training. He has a degree in hotel and restaurant management, but that career didn't pan out. He says it's hard to see how much his life will actually change.
I'm a felon without a driver's license, and so, you know, even if I did have an address, that would put a pretty big damper on a lot of jobs.
Luna used to be addicted to heroin, but now he's in treatment. He has a caseworker, but no housing. A disability put Luna in the hospital 10 years ago. Nerve damage from a construction job. He couldn't work, so he started selling drugs. He's been in and out of prison since he was 13, but he says he's never going back to jail because of his son, who lives with his mom. The 10-year-old boy doesn't know his dad is homeless.
You know, he has no idea that I have to sleep on the street sometimes, and very purposely, I make him think that I'm just fine, even if I'm not.
David LaFleur also spent years on the street after losing his job, waiting for something to happen. I meet LaFleur in an alley off 6th Street in San Francisco. It's a place you wouldn't really want to walk through, at least not at night. It's full of trash. There's some empty fenced-in parking lots.
This was my reality at one time, you know, was this alleyway. You know, a lot has happened to me in this alleyway right here.
This is where LaFleur slept and did drugs, on and off, for 6 years. He doesn't really like to come here now that he doesn't have a reason to. For him, a walk down memory lane isn't bittersweet. It's just bitter.
And I built a cardboard condo, if you will. It was made out of plywood and cardboard and stuff like that. It was pretty cozy.
A few homeless folks sit in the alley today next to some garbage bags. They'd probably find it hard to believe this tall, well-groomed man used to live here. The truth is, LaFleur is still technically homeless. He lives in a clean and sober program house. He's been out of work for half a decade. Today, LaFleur is focused on finding work. His launch pad is the San Francisco Public Library main branch, just 2 blocks from the alleyway. He's here at the library every day, surfing job sites and faxing his resume.
I'm looking for, actually, this website that a friend of mine gave me, and it has jobs on it, so...
LaFleur's 51. He hasn't had regular work since he was laid off 6 years ago from a job installing metal roll-up doors. His backpack is stuffed with notes and copies of his resume. He's answered more than 350 job ads in the past year. LaFleur struggles with computer skills, and he has trouble getting interviews.
Yeah, that's a job that I'm applying for, this one right here, which is a spa service technician. That's what I normally do. I'm also an iron worker by trade.
LaFleur went to community college. He grew up near San Francisco. He was paying rent on a nice house where he lived with his girlfriend. Even when he lost his job, he never thought he'd end up homeless. He started using drugs and went to prison for a while. When he got out, he found out he was manic depressive.
It was a step-by-step process. It's like you lose your job, you lose your relationship, then your cars, and then... You know, the only thing you're really holding on to is the roof over your head.
Today, things are looking up. LaFleur just found out that he was approved to move into a residential hotel. It's been a long time since he had 4 walls that belong just to him.
I'm not going to be homeless anymore, that's what I'm saying.
San Francisco spends $38 million a year on supportive housing. But subsidized housing isn't all it's cracked up to be. Just ask Kathleen Lee. She and her partner, Susan Hansen, live in the Tenderloin, San Francisco's seediest neighborhood.
This is where I live. This is the rent. It's 4 floors. I live on the 4th floor.
The Winton is one of hundreds of residential hotels subsidized by the city, and officially it's temporary housing. But some people have lived here for a decade, even raised children, in a hotel room that's only 150 square feet. 2008 was the year Lee and Hansen became homeless. The couple was painting high-end homes when the market collapse took most of their clients' disposable income.
It was just like the light switch. Somebody flipped it off and there was no more work. Just stopped.
The couple had a secret. They were addicted to heroin. They lost their house in Sacramento when they couldn't pay the rent. They packed their stuff into their car with Molly the hound dog and drove into San Francisco. Lee remembers their first night on the street.
We had been broke down and living in the car, kind of just waiting for them to tow it. We'd go back every night, and if the car was still there, we'd sleep in it. The day that it wasn't there, we wouldn't sleep in it anymore, kind of doing it like that. And the car was gone.
The women were in their late 50s. They got sores from sleeping on the sidewalk. They collected bottles for money, but Lee got sick from putting her head in trash cans to scavenge for recyclables.
It is so raw and desperate and freaked out. And we knew a little, we knew that the Tenderloin was here. We knew this is where you would go to get assistance of some sort. We had not a clue what we were asking for.
One day, someone from San Francisco's homeless outreach team asked them if they needed any help. They went through a detox program and got placed in a room.
How you been, hound dog?
Oh,
how you been today? You talking?
Their rent is $650 a month, cheap by San Francisco standards. And they're grateful, even if the communal bathroom is filthy and the building is infested with bedbugs. Their housing is subsidized by welfare.
Over here is our little sink. This is where we wash our hands, wash our dishes, wash our faces, drain our spaghetti.
Lee just got home from work. Hansen has made her special kitchen sink vegetable barley soup on a camp stove they keep under the bed. She buys the ingredients at the farmer's market with food stamps. While we eat, I ask if they ever saw themselves with this kind of a life. Hansen says no.
We're white girls from the suburbs, and it just, it's different. You're in everybody's business whether you want to be or not. Sometimes I hate it, sometimes it makes me laugh, and sometimes it pisses me off and makes me sad. So we are rebuilding our lives.
Today, Lee works 20 hours a week at the public library. Her job is to reach out to homeless library users on behalf of a social worker. She likes helping people facing the same situation she was in.
I'm just living proof. Look, here I am. And look, there I was. Right, I'm right where you were, and now I'm here, and you too can do this if you want to, or whatever part of it you want to do.
Of the three people I spent time with, Lee and Hansen are most likely to leave homelessness behind. There's a rolled-up rug in their closet wrapped in plastic that's too big for their room. They can't wait to unroll it in their next apartment.
That piece was reported by Julia Scott and originally aired on Marketplace from American Public Media. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. At KLW, our community storytelling team, Hear Here, met one woman in Oakland who's experienced a similar journey to those of the people you just met.
An ideal life right now is just having a place to lay down and every night inside where you're warm and you can run the heat.
Barbara Lindsay was born and raised in Oakland, but now lives in her car in Berkeley. She had this question for our listeners.
Yeah, I'd like to know, how does one go about getting a place to stay? How does one really get help? It's like I get the runaround in it. It seems like social services, like all these groups are really overwhelmed, you know. And they refer you and refer you and refer you, and it's like I'm not really getting any real help. And I don't know. I really need help, you know.
If you're a service provider, how would you answer Barbara's question? Or if you're also someone in need of assistance, what questions would you like answered? You can give us a call at 415-264-7106. That number, just to leave us a message, is 415-264-7106. And to hear the rest of Barbara Lindsay's story and our other Hear Hear community stories, visit us at kalw.org and click on Hear Hear. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Our economic system requires most of us to work because, well, let's face it, most things cost money. But some are priceless, like love and time. And somewhere between those two extremes lives the sharing economy, where all you need is a helping hand.
It's always more fun to share with everyone.
No coercion, no compulsion, just purely for the spirit of generosity.
Hey, Bert, would you share that half a cookie with me?
Sharing is hard sometimes for everyone, isn't it?
Instead of saying, what can I get, what can I give?
In today's installment of our series, we're going to talk about something that doesn't have to cost a dime, and that is to dance. All you really need is a good song with a beat and an environment where you can let loose. But dance clubs can often be more about how you look or how sophisticated your moves are than focusing on the joy of dancing. Here in the Bay Area, there's a thriving community of dancers that are not about the spectacle side of dancing. This group is into encouraging creative expression in whatever form it might take.
You can rest on the floor, or you can dance standing up. You can dance to the rhythm or not to the rhythm. You don't need any formal training. There's no steps. It's like a dance in your living room with your friends.
That's Zach Pine, a proponent of this kind of freestyle dancing. KLW's Jen Chien takes us to a dance event that he co-organizes that's taking the concept of freestyle a little bit further.
When it comes to going out dancing, most people think of it as a Saturday night type of affair.
What? You know what I want to do?
What?
Strut.
Putting on some pomade, slicking on a little lipstick, and hitting the dance floor with some sweet moves that'll put all eyes on you. Well, it's 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, and for these dancers, this is the perfect time to get their groove on. Inside the barn-like space at Ashkenaz Community Center, a trio of women in sweatpants and bare feet do an improvised line dance. A man lies still on the worn wooden floor with his eyes closed. Others are stretching or just swaying to the beat. There are adults and kids of all ages, including several toddlers and one small baby. People look comfortable, not dressed to impress.
That's not a warm-up, that's a hot-up.
This is Soul Sanctuary, a community freestyle dance event that happens here every Sunday.
Community freestyle dances, everyone just comes and dances however they wish.
Daniel Ari is one of the main organizers of Soul Sanctuary and also today's DJ.
You know, people dance out whatever mood they're in. People are very still. We have people of all abilities, ages, and people just dance however they wish to the music.
Although the dancing itself is free form, the two-hour event does have a loose structure. After a warm-up period, the whole group meets for a brief opening circle.
Everyone, let's have a quick circle.
Then, the main event, a long session of freestyle dancing. In the last 15 minutes, people gather in a circle again and formally introduce themselves.
This is Gerhard.
And I'm Zach.
This is Zach, and I'm Judith.
This is Judith.
And I'm Jen.
Organic fruit is passed around the closing circle as people share their thoughts and experiences.
My name is Anna, and this is my second week. I was always looking for a place where I could enjoy myself and my daughter, too. And coming here, I feel so free, so relaxed.
Soul Sanctuary has been going since 2003. But 2 years ago, they decided to do away with admission fees and become 100% volunteer-run. Inspired by other local organizations like Berkeley's Karma Kitchen, they've adopted a gift economy model. There's still a box where people can put money, but as co-organizer Zach Pine explains,
the idea is that you don't put the box right by the door like it's an admission box. It's away from our admission area, and it just says if you want to pay it forward, you can. So there's no obligation for anyone who comes to put anything in there.
Pine says paying it forward is a little different than just accepting donations. At a donation-based event,
there's kind of the understanding that you give the money, and then the money gets kind of broken up into whatever the pieces are it has to get broken up into, and it's done. Whereas if you have the idea that your dance is already paid for as a gift from people who came before you, right away you're receiving something. You know, you're valuing it as something that's been given to you. And then when you, if you wish and if you can afford to pay it forward, you're saying, I want this to continue for other people, even if I'm not here.
Soul Sanctuary dancers have made it clear they want this dance to continue. In the 2 years since they switched to the gift economy model, they've actually built up a small surplus.
We're hosted in Ashkenaz Music and Dance Community Center, which is a nonprofit, and as a result of that, our rent is quite low. So we can afford to have a low budget with low rent, and also volunteer work goes into the dance.
The organizers say it takes about $4,000 and 350 hours of volunteer time to run the dance each year. But participant Nancy Alima Ali says the dance runs on something more valuable.
It's about your energy, and it's about the exchanging energy, and rather, and that can be in the form of money, and that can be in the form of dancing, and that can be in the form of doing volunteer work. But that really, ultimately, the idea is that you do get more out of it than you put into it.
Participant Erica Leonard agrees.
You know, money is not part of do I go. Sometimes I don't even think about money until I'm walking and go, oh, what am I going to give today? And so much of, you know, do we go to the movies? Do we go to dinner? Is such a complicated thing. This is just my heart that brings me here.
Which is unusual. The typical rules that go with partner dancing or how to move to a particular kind of music don't apply here. At a place like this, dancing can be anything you want it to be.
You can lie on the floor. You can interact with people. You can not interact with people. And it's rare to find a place where you can really get in touch with yourself and find out, well, what do I want to do? What do I want to give? Rather than what's everybody wanting me to give. So it's freeing.
Organizer Zach Pine says hopefully that freedom translates into something people can take with them when they leave the dance floor.
Real life has a lot of scary things, but when you carry it around with you, then you can have the freedom to try new things and to do new things and to have a, you know, positive effect in the world.
Pine says that's the kind of paying it forward worth dancing for. In Berkeley, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
You can find more information about the Soul Sanctuary Dance in Berkeley at our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can hear all of the stories in our Sharing Economy series. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Leela Day, RTM's Kunahoffs, and Stephen Short.
I don't like to use seasonal ceramic cups outside of their respective seasons.
Why not?
Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor, Martina Castro is our managing editor, and Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to our partners at the East Bay Express. You'll find them online at eastbayexpress.com. This is the band Yonat and her muse. Singer Yonat Mayer has been compared to Nora Jones and Adele, but she probably prefers you consider her on her own. The band is currently recording an album in the Oakland Hills, but they also like to get out of the studio. They have two shows scheduled this week on both sides of the bridge, the Bottom of the Hill Club in San Francisco on Friday and on Sunday at the Starry Plow in Berkeley. For more information, go to kalw.org and click on local music. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.